I'll dive in because I was like, oh, how much time now? Last week I set out the idea that I kind of am interested in writing something that looks at not just kind of periods of Hinduism and not just kind of themes in Hinduism, but actually something more like underlying concepts that, if you have them, they work as hermeneutic keys. They help you to understand a whole range of other concepts within Hinduism. Is there any chance? You've got a handout, but there's not quite enough, so maybe two people can share. You sure?
We can share.
It's quite helpful to have the text, I think, in some ways. So kind of underlying hermeneutic concepts that once you understand them, they start to illuminate a wider range of things. And that's both because I think at the moment when other cultures try to understand Hinduism, there are really fundamental underlying differences in the concepts that people are using. And so translation of the concepts is problematic. And also because there's a lot of hidden theory in here, a lot of hidden theoretical assumptions that aren't always brought out. And last week I talked about this kind of notion and the idea that actually we ought to start developing theory out of a Hindu source rather than just out of Western thought. And the idea that when you look at a lot of contemporary philosophy... When you look at a lot of contemporary philosophy, it's rooted in Christian and quite a lot of it's rooted in Jewish thought as well. Very little in Muslim thought, certainly very little in polytheistic thought, very little in animist thought, very little in Taoist thought, although China has actually been developing its own theory based on Taoist and Confucian thinking. And that's kind of wanting. Even though there have been all these moments when people in the West said, we really ought to do this. You know, people like Heidegger saying, I think we're stuck in our way of thinking. We need to go look at some other cultures. How about Taoism? But no one's really... There were a couple of moves to go and check out potential connections, and then people sort of gave up. So I'm interested in doing that. I think one of the reasons people had to give up was because the comparative thing was a very difficult thing to do, to jump from one idea and look, you know, to start with Heidegger and look for answers in another culture is problematic. Rather, you need to develop the theory from the ground up in the first place. And I started to talk about that a little bit with regard to concepts of God, of deity and divinity last week, but I didn't get very far, largely because it is a work in progress. I'm trying to write the book as I do the seminar series, and so I hadn't gotten very far myself. And so I'm going to set out a couple of categories with regard to texts and sources and ideas that I think might be useful for trying to illuminate Hindu concepts of deity and divinity. And then I'm going to go on and do that with self. And I'm just going to sketch each category, and you can tell me afterwards whether you think they're crazy or they need to be altered or they are imposed upon the material and something else would be better. That's fine. And one of the things I want to do is to suggest that they might be helpful for understanding Hindu concepts and also maybe point to cases or studies or material that supports them. So in regard to deity and divinity, and some things I'll actually read out from the material that I've kind of made as notes and potential text. So deity and divinity, I've actually shifted now to look at personalism, a couple of different categories of what it means, I think, to understand Hindu personalism. To some extent, intimacy, philosophy, mood, and fluidity. And those categories are going to get brought out a little bit more. My basis for thinking about deity in this case is this. There's been a long tradition of failure to adequately give account of the Hindu concept of the divine, despite the various technical terms that people have tried to create to be applied to it. Polytheism is problematic. Pantheism is problematic. We were just talking about henotheism and kathenotheism, terms invented by Max Muller to try and coin the special characteristic of Hindu divinity. But all of these have, A, not been picked up, B, are very imprecise, and maybe just with that impreciseness are often simply incorrect, and of course are different for different cases of thinking about Hinduism. We haven't gotten further than that. So where the Jewish, Christian, and Islamic understandings of both the divine and the self can be hermeneutically unpacked. So in the case of the divine, you can understand the Jewish, Christian, and Islamic gods to some extent by reference to the frameworks that are established in ancient Near Eastern polytheism. Once you start understanding the way that gods were understood in the ancient Near Eastern culture, you understand the Christian, for instance, concept of God better. And also then you need to understand the Platonic apotheosis of abstract ideas and ideals. You can't really understand the way the Christian God develops without understanding Plato and how that influences their notion of the divine as an abstract being, a body. What kind of bodiless entity could there be? Oh, there's a one a bit like Plato's ideas. And you start putting those together and you get a good framework for understanding how the Christian idea of God, for instance, works. And you add onto that Aristotle's notion of the deity in relation to ontological conceptions of existence and grounding. And again, only when you understand Aristotle's understanding of being can you understand the way that people think of God as existing subsequently when they talk about divine being. So we have specific contexts that, not that everyone agrees with Aristotle, Plato, or that this is really still the ancient Near Eastern God, but when you get them, you can start to get what kind of a God there is in Christianity and why he or it behaves in the way it does. But it seems to me that this hasn't been done very much in regard to Hindu depictions, nor indeed in regard really to sort of East Asian depictions of God, or indigenous cultures of other continents, Americas, Africa. So people haven't done a lot to really get into the ways to understand animisms or polytheisms or East Asian notions of reality and the divine, and for instance the Tao. Or chi, let's say. So I'm interested in that. And just with regard to the divine, I'll briefly go through those, and that kind of sets me up to talk more about the self. It seems to me, as I said last week, that personalism needs to be reconsidered. And I've ended up dividing this into a couple of different sections. I mean, I don't want to make an axiological comparison between Christianity and Hinduism. That's unhelpful, but I think it is helpful to be able to refer to other conceptions to clarify what we're trying to do. Whereas to understand the personality of God in Christianity, there's a really, what I think what often ends up happening is you say, okay, well, there's the Hebrew Bible God who's frequently interacting with characters. And sometimes is seen as, thank you, kind of almost seen in almost a feudal context. Here is a being who is your lord, who you have conversations with. Thank you, Lucy. And that then later comes into conflict, actually, with the Platonic idea that God is kind of an idea or an ideal or is the good. And that creates great confusion, and I think it's one of the reasons why people stop talking to God, why God stops talking to people very much. Right, prayer becomes a one-sided relation where people talk to God, but God doesn't tend to talk back after a certain point in the development of Christian literature, or in very abstract terms, or sends messages, or something like that. But this is very, you know, if you're expecting this, and when you go look at the Hindu material, it's very confusing, because you have a radically different kind of personalism. These are gods with whom you live in a kind of a genuine interactive community of relationship. So I'm going to talk about communitarian personalism. And I said last week that I think that comes from a history that we see throughout Southeast Asia of understanding people in relation to supernatural beings. In India, as in much of Southeast Asia, supernatural beings are understood to fill the landscape of this world and other heavenly and demonic worlds in a range of forms, from spirits and demons, ancestral spirits and ghosts, to smaller and larger deities and supreme gods. So it's a whole range of different kinds of non-human beings that you can meet across the whole of Asia. And that's what I referred to in terms of kind of the animist background of the religion. And this requires an acknowledgement of supernatural presences existing at the everyday level along human lives. As such, it establishes a sense of community with real and unseen agents. Rather than the feudal paradigm where you kind of ask for audience with a being above, we have a kind of a protective paradigm, a village relationships paradigm of mutual affiliation, commitment, and care between all these different beings. And it seems to me that's a better paradigm to use to understand the way in which people in Hinduism are perfectly happy to interact with the deity, live in a community with the deity, care for the deity every day, and see kind of the agency of the deity and deities, and indeed other beings, as constantly influencing their kind of everyday worldly realm of life. So both that neighborliness and that sense of a genuine direct causal interaction, I think, is really important for understanding the Hindu context. And if you're just a Hindu scholar, sometimes one doesn't recognize that that's important. But when you try and explain Hinduism to people from other cultures and they're very confused by the God being in the tree or the God being in the image, or the God being involved in your everyday life in a much more personal and kind of mutual way, I think, then it's helpful to kind of set that paradigm out. I haven't put a text example for that, and I'm looking for a good example, probably something about village deities and the way, for even the goddess Meenakshi at the Madurai temple, who, in the context of kind of Murtiseva, everyone's kind of involved with her daily life. When she awakes and when she, you know, she's bathed, and people are aware of the festival and her year and her relations with her consort. So there's a kind of a living alongside a neighbour element there, which I'm interested in. Another paradigm, just for understanding personalism, is what I've called psychological personalism. And here I think it's important to see that, again, there's a kind of psychology that you don't usually apply to God in Jewish, Christian, and Muslim contexts, that you do apply to Hindu gods. God, the Christian God, again, as an example, doesn't really have psychology, because he doesn't have a mind in the normal sense of decision-making, gathering knowledge, trying to figure things out, having emotions that change and conflict and that you have to mediate at different moments, having other people who he interacts with within his own level as a community. So all the things that usually define human psychology are kind of absent from the Abrahamic God. To some extent, and again, I know that there's a lot of argument there, that if there are Christian theologians, they will contradict me, but I think to some extent that that's right, and that's one of the reasons why people then focus on the psychology of Jesus. And even with Jesus, famously, it's controversial if you say, you know, and then he was upset, then he was confused, then he wasn't quite sure what he wanted to do, then he was irritated, as he often clearly is in things like the Gospel of Mark, but that's a complicated set of psychological things to associate. I think it's important to kind of show that's very different in the Hindu context. Most deities are involved in genuine narratively structured lives, whether they're Krishna, about whom a widely known biography exists and can be relived in drama and narrative. Like, Krishna has a whole biography, kind of birth to disappearance, which we see in extensively developed and complex literatures that look in detail at his relationships and motivations. And that's the kind, that's what makes Hindu gods seem weirdly personal to people who aren't used to that. You know, people say, isn't that anthropomorphic? Doesn't that somehow worldify? Doesn't it lower in some sense the god? And we kind of want to say, no, that's not what's going on here. Or the different kinds of gods, Shasti, the goddess who you see in certain village contexts, about whom people tell stories when they do rituals asking her for aid. There's a strong sense of narrative, of story, and of a kind of a psychology involved in these deities. And there's a nice quote from David Haberman when he describes the Krishna who pilgrims meet in Vrindavan. This one's not on the sheet, I should put it on. And he describes that Krishna as an immediately present deity whose realness is tied up in his capricious individual will. He is not an abstract principle. One of the things about Krishna is he keeps you on your toes, actually. And that capriciousness is really important. Haberman writes, he's a mischievous, youthful lover who turns the world upside down with his predictable play. His unpredictable play. He's a joker, a thief, a prankster with a bottomless bag of amusing tricks, one who delights in foiling established order. So the opposite of the Platonic god who follows a principle only acts if it fulfills a set and unerring principle. Far from being a sober and judgmental god, Krishna is an unpredictable, mischievous boy who likes to romp the forest, playfully teasing all he encounters. Krishna is ultimate reality assuming unexpected forms. His ways are ultimately unknowable. Only those who can surrender the desire for mastery and let go in a world of uncertainty are free to dance with him. And that's exactly, again, one of the things that's confusing and challenging to people who expect a very different kind of deity, a deity who represents divinity of a different kind. And I brought that out a little bit in, this is from the Gita Govinda, where you can see it's not only that we kind of relate to him in that way, but in some of the poetry that's brought out, so you get to see inside the psychology of the gods. My favourite example of this is the beginning, I think it's of the Uddhava Sandesha, when Krishna is sad and he's in tears. And I used to use this for students and say, Krishna's having really strong emotions and he's really sad and he's regretful, he's unhappy. And they'd say, but God can't have those feelings. That's really strange. And what you get is a profound sort of psychological insight. And a little bit of it is here in the Gita Govinda. As night came, he approached Radha, finding the force of her anger softened, this suggestion of fear, of concern, of waiting to see what's happening. He's omniscient. Surely he doesn't need to see how she's doing. Her face weak from endless sighing. At dusk, she stared in shame at her friend's face as Hari stammered his blissful words. And that stammering is something a Western god would never do. And I'm not sure if a Western god gets to feel bliss either. You are my ornament, my life, my jewel in the sea of existence. Be yielding to me forever. My heart fervently pleads. When does God plead? Radha, cherished love, abandon your baseless pride. Love's fire burns my heart. Bring wine in your lotus mouth. And bringing out that psychological richness and depth, I think, is really important. And that kind of leads me into maybe another element I want to highlight, which is the notion of a mood and dispositional personalism. I was just saying that it seems to me that the deities, people often then say, well, how can this deity be a deity if they're just a psychology and they're confused and lost and sometimes upset and sometimes in love and sometimes regretful? What's deity like about them? And it seems to me all of that fits into something larger, which is to do with the creation of a certain mood. Each deity doesn't symbolize a single thing necessarily, but each deity exists within a certain mood. And in reading Rumprasad Sen particularly, I was thinking about the mood it seems to me that each deity brings out or illustrates with their actions in stories, in their actual embodied life, is a mood of a certain mood or attitude of living life. They're kind of illustrating to us a certain way to be, a certain disposition towards the world. So that the symbolism or significance of deities is a topic that tends to be little understood. We may ask what a deity symbolizes. But they're very complex, and often you get deities who don't symbolize a simple thing. And this leads to confusion about the erotic asceticism of Shiva, or the painful play of Krishna, or the fierce and yet childless maternal character of Durga. And Durga, and especially in Kali, you have a mother who's really, A, doesn't have children. She does as Parvati, but as Durga she doesn't, and as Kali she doesn't. And a mother who's pretty scary, a bloody mother, basically. And people see this as a conflict. And again, people kind of go, what's going on here? We can't understand that. And I kind of want to show the way in which this actually exemplifies a certain mood of approach to life, evoked in depictions of the deity, which then cue particular attitudes in the devotees themselves. And they're not just attitudes of worship towards the deity, they're other attitudes towards the life experience of the world. So the significance of deities then is often one of an existential disposition. The deity themselves conveys a worldview. Right, so that you see, arguably, we see this in Krishna literatures that encourage the savoring of aesthetic experience in life, or in Kali literatures that encourage a positive relishing of one's suffering, or in Shaiva literatures that encourage a way of paying attention to the difficult realities of the world with a clear mind and an attitude of kind of aware dispassion that goes along with Krishna the yogi in some sense. And I think to some extent you see this. This is a wonderful poem from Rumprasad Sen. Does suffering scare me, O mother? Let me suffer in this world. Do I require more? Suffering runs ahead of me and runs after me. I carry it on my head and set up a stand in the bazaar to peddle it. I'm a poison worm. I thrive on poison. I carry it wherever I go. Prasad says, mother, lift off my load. I need a little rest. Yet it's amazing. Others brag about their happiness. I brag about my suffering. And that mood, that disposition, seems to me really important towards to understanding what a deity signifies. So that's another one. Where have I gotten to? Mood and disposition. Presence and intimacy I've talked about before, and that's really something that comes up. That's a lot's been written about that, the notion that the divine takes embodiment in the physical world. People used to talk about pantheism, nature is God and God is nature. And pantheism actually led to a lot of misconceptions and a lot of denigration of Hinduism. It was seen as reductive. If God's nature, why bother to call it God? Just call it nature. Get rid of the God part. And I think Hinduism was often seen as materialistic. But what's happened now, of course, is that paradigm's changed through lots of work on Vyuhas and Pancharatra actually as a philosophical foundation for this way of thinking, and Murtis and Murtiseva and people, Joanne Waghorn's book on images in Hinduism, where people are starting to rethink that and see the presence of the divine in the physical world as something you have to understand in a different way. So I'm interested in working on that, and working on not only on the way in which you have this kind of, I think Gavin somewhere talks about it, the congealing of the divine. If the divine is everywhere already, there's a congealing in particularly intense forms. But also look at the different kinds of thing that the divine can manifest as. The idea that when the divine becomes something materially accessible in the world, that can be a range of different forms that material reality take in the world. And this is going to link to truths about the self as well, so that sometimes the divine manifests as the Murti, sometimes the divine manifests as a person, an avatar, or simply sort of takes form in a certain person. Sometimes the divine manifests as a place, of course. It might be Mount Kailasa, it might be, and there's a nice quote again, I think, from David Haberman: according to Braj Vaishnavism, this entire world is Krishna. And he brings out this idea that when the divine then manifests as a place, and I think in Swaminarayan theology, you've got manifestations of God as the dharma, as the actual place, the region in which one goes to dwell. You've got the divine manifesting as a particular quality, or actually manifesting as a mood. Again, and Haberman goes on. He is the beautiful sunset that was enchanting me. He's describing his visit to Braj. He's a beautiful sunset that was enchanting me, the road that blistered my feet, the sun that scorched me. He is this very world in all its wonderfully twisted multiplicity of forms. There is no need to tear away the surface for some metaphysical depth. The diverse world, as it appears, is it. Right. So, but that world is not just the physical world of objects. And that old discourse about idolatry as the divine taking an object form, I think, is wrong. The divine takes moods, it takes atmospheres, it takes places, it takes persons, situations, almost psychological relationships. And I was working on a paper previously that kind of says it takes whole stories on as a manifestation of the divine. So that I think there's a much there's an interesting exploration of the different forms of presence that the divine can take that's waiting to be done there. And I think just two more themes on the divine. I've said before, and I keep coming up back to this, that I think the fluid divinity or the fluid ontology of the divine is something people have to understand the way in which the divine is not a single entity. I think the Western tradition spends a lot of time famously thinking of the divine in terms of substance, existence. It therefore thinks of the divine as an entity, an object. It then is really confused about that because it knows that God's supposed to be out of the world and not an object. And then you get the whole of from Aquinas through to Duns Scotus through to Heidegger through to Derrida and Levinas, everyone talking about being and non-being and trying to cancel out the fact that they've just called God an existing being, i.e. an object. And it really messes up theology, basically. And actually Rumprasad Chakravarti's recent book, Divine Self, Human Self, is kind of about that, exploring that idea that God's not supposed to be an object, and kind of using that.
What's not to be?
Well, the book is Rumprasad Chakravarti.
Yeah.
He just did a book called Divine Self, Human Self. I can show you afterwards.
No, it's all right. I just missed what you said.
What the book was, that's the one. And he's kind of writing it almost in dialogue with Christian theologians to try and say, look, here are new ways to think about that issue. And I think that raises two issues. One is that affects the ontology of the divine insofar as what kind of an object you think it is and what kind of rules then affect the way the divine exists. And I'm interested in the ways in which people are trying to think about that, and particularly metaphors of fluid that you find recurring through Hindu texts, from the Chandogya Upanishad, which uses a lot of fluid metaphors. God is the rivers flowing to the ocean. God is the clay taking different forms. It is the gold molded into different ornaments. And there are problems that come up later theologically with that. It's Parinamavada. It suggests transformation. But still, it comes up again and again, so that also Kashmiri Shaivas use the image of the divine as a fluid. You get the lake that has different currents in it. It makes different waves. Throughout, many different Vedanta schools refer to the divine as a kind of a fluid that can take different forms. It congeals into curds if it's milk, or it gets whipped up into foam if it's water. And the idea is to say this is not a thing. This is something that can expand, it can extend, it can take different forms, it can be divided and yet still remain of the same substance, etc. And there's a nice, the South Indian theologian Pillai Lokacharya uses a fluid metaphor to describe the five different types of divine manifestation that Sri Vaishnavas attributed to Vishnu. So the Lord, as can be inner controller of the self, kind of the soul, is like water deep down in this earth. It's a hidden sort of foundation. His worldly emanation is like the sea of milk. So that's kind of reality that takes this huge oceanic form. His manifestations on earth are like rivers in flood. So you have a channeling in a particular direction for a particular purpose with powerful effect. But incarnations as images, murtis, are like deep wells in that they're local and accessible to everyone. And I think that's kind of typical and interesting that you get this fluid metaphor used to explain the way that the divine can exist as a multi-bounded, infinitely extendable, many-centered kind of a being. And so the other side of that, as well as that fluid ontology, you've got what I've tried to think of in terms of what the West often refers to the God of the philosophers. How do the philosophers see God? I think it's also important for people, they see this personal depiction of the divine, they see this immediate sort of physical material presence of the divine, and maybe don't always see the way in which the Brahman concept is still in some ways back there somewhere. So that you get again and again the notion that the divine, as it's defined from the Nasadiya Sukta onwards almost, that which is not just existence, but exists being and non-being, before being and non-being, and again, the very derivation of the word Brahman, a support for all reality, comes up in all these different forms throughout the different texts. The Puranas are amazing because as visual and personal as they get, they repeatedly refer to the Brahman levels of the divine. And I won't read the whole thing, but I've just put in an example from the Shiva Purana, where famously he assumes the form of the lingam and says of it in the second paragraph there, "This secret truth of Brahman I am revealing to you out of love. I am the supreme Brahman. My form is both manifest and unmanifest in view of my Brahmahood and supreme lordliness," and so on and so forth. And that's expressed in the visual image of the lingam. And you get a similar speech from Durga in the Devi Mahatmya and in other goddess texts. And, of course, one of the most wonderful visual depictions of that world-supporting character of divinities, whenever they're seen as supreme, is the Vishwarupa in the Bhagavad Gita, where you get the divine as visually showing you all of reality bounded within it and forming a support for that. Actually, the image I prefer is the image from the Bhagavata Purana when his mother looks in his mouth and sees the world circling. That's a wonderful combination of the Brahman elements and the kind of psychological, intimate, personal sides of the divine as well. You really get them together in those images. And I think that's something that you don't see in other religions very clearly. The whole point of Jesus is that it's very hard to see his godhood. He never goes, "By the way, here it is. This is me as God." And God never goes, "Here's me," in a way that you can access. And what you have in the Hindu context is a really striking mix of kind of the cosmological and philosophical with the accessible manifest forms. Well, I'm leaving that there for now. I think the last category that I want to look at in terms of the divine is the way in which all of that allows for a certain kind of intimacy with the divine that I think is different from the kind of intimacy that you get with the divine in Christian, Jewish, and Muslim contexts. I think all of those contexts, and especially Christianity, and to some extent Judaism as well, prayer is a space in which you have an intimate relationship with God. You know, people don't tend to say, "I saw God," sometimes, but not usually. They don't tend to say, "I just heard God." They don't tend to say, "I was just imagining," or in my spiritual world, "I was being in the arms of God," or "in the presence of God," or "right there with God." Prayer is the way an address, speech, direct relational conversation is really essential to that. But I think the intimacy that you find in the Hindu context is very, very different, and it relates to that embodied presence, that sense of a shared neighborly kind of community, that you have a right of access, that this is a psychology that expresses what it expresses in a more complex but kind of psychologically engaging way. All of that, of course, is underpinned by the philosophical level, by the notion that you have a right to this because God is within you as well as without, that there is a commonality ontologically. You're not doing as Levinas tells us to do in the sort of Abrahamic tradition. You're not constantly standing before the radical otherness and the infinite superiority of the divine. It is those things in some respects, but that's not the basis of your relationship. And you see that coming out a lot in 20th century Abrahamic theology. So if we were doing the same for the self and the soul, how would that work? This is a really hard one, and this is the one that I'm only just, again, kind of starting to come on to provide potentially useful perspectives on. And I've ended up looking at just four categories. One, the notion of a questioning subject, the person who, before you even get to philosophy of the self, is the person who asks questions in all texts, in all cases, the one who comes forward and says, what about me? The second one will be the many-leveled body, so that the notion of the body in the West as this kind, either this Gnostic vessel for a spark that hides inside of it. The Gnostic perspective tends to take material bodies as just matter, and matter is a certain substance, it's nasty, it's all the same kind of substance. I think is in the Indian context, the recent work of people like Dominic Wujastic and David Gordon White and others has shown that the body in Hinduism is not a single thing, it's many, many, many different kinds of thing, and that requires us to think in a different way about it. I didn't print out that bit of my text, but it's really interesting, I think, that, well, I'll come back to that in a second. So you have a many-leveled body. The third category is the oceanic self, a term that gets taken up by Sigmund Freud, actually, that he borrows in theory from Romain Rolland, who borrowed it from Ramakrishna, the Bengali mystic. But the notion that the self is not a single fixed monad, not a little object that goes around, but actually is much more fluid. It can flow out of itself. It can take other forms, and the possession tradition has made that explicitly clear. And the last one would be indexical identity. And so just briefly, people have suggested that we need to rethink the self. And actually the self is probably, if we're looking for areas of Hindu culture that have received theoretical attention, the self is one of the ones that has actually received quite a lot of attention. People gave up on the divine. But we've had people recently from Janardhan Gneri, through Ramprasad Chakravarti, through Staneshwar Timosina, through to some extent Fred Smith, through to Gavin Flood, thinking about what the self is in a Hindu context, and finding it very exciting and using this actually to interrogate a wider range of contexts as well. And so I've put a quote from Fred Smith there that I won't look at now, but kind of looking at the way that possession raises issues about the kind of things that a self can be. Before getting into the sort of philosophical, actually I'm going to work backwards through these. There's a lot of attention to the notion, perhaps one of the most philosophically sophisticated notions that you find. So that's the last category on the last page, indexical identity. The idea that, I think philosophically this is really important, the Hindu tradition very early says, who is it who's having this thought right now? Almost no, certainly the Western tradition has a bit of trouble doing that. Plato suggests, but he doesn't really look at that question. He looks at the contents of your thoughts, but he doesn't say, who is this right now? So the notion in Hinduism of kind of the witness of your thoughts is to some extent absent from much of Western history, so that when you get Descartes going, I think, therefore I am, it's kind of this shocking revelation in the early Renaissance period. And but what he actually says is, I am my thoughts. So the whole phenomenological tradition in the West says, what are the thoughts that I'm having? And it is simply true that the Indian context, people had said a millennium or two before, no, I'm not my thoughts. My thoughts change, but the fact of the person having the thoughts, of course, does not. So you have what's sometimes called the indexical I, this underlying witness. And that underlies certain approaches to the self in the Upanishads and, of course, to Brahman as well. You see quite a lot of it in texts like the Kano Upanishad. By what do I think? By what? What is the foundation for all these thoughts? Famously, you see it in the Mandukya Upanishad. And it's brought out in Gaudapada, in Advaita Vedanta, in studies of Kashmiri Shaivism. And more recently, it's come out in possession accounts, where if we go back to Fred Smith's earlier quote, you see he kind of says, is there a foundation? What is it that's possessed? What happens when we shift and change identities? And so I'm interested in that. Staneshwar Timosin has tried to show that the self is actually constituted both by the mind as it shifts and changes and by this indexical underlying foundation, the one who is always there underneath the changes. And so the possessions become a really interesting place to look at that. But also I think there needs to be more done on this in the arts and with regard to empathy. If you look at Whitney Sanford's book on Paramanand, I think, Songs to Krishna, or at Jack Hawley's book on Sur Das, where he looks at vision and metaphors of vision, or a recent article by Karen Pichilis, I think it is, in the Journal of Hindu Studies on poetry to Shiva, but I can't remember which author she looks at. And indeed, something that I wrote on Radha, the notion that when you get involved in bhakti literature, they're highly empathetic. You have to feel with the character, and actually what they're trying to do partly is to take you in and let you shift your identity and become that character at some level. And that kind of comes out in the Raganuga Bhakti Sadhana idea that your identity is shiftable, you can become someone else. So that there's a kind of a shifting of identities that happens here because all indexical eyes are in fact the same. And that leads into the notion of an oceanic self. I think that's come out more and more. It kind of relates to the fluid divinity idea, the idea that the self is not just bounded within the body. Of course, it flows over into other lives and other bodies. The idea that possession, there's a lot done on this now by David Gordon White, and I think it's Arnold Bohler wrote a book on the open body in the volume on body Indian views of the body that I've got in the other room. Talks about the open body, and White talks about kind of the permeable boundaries, and Fred Smith's book on possession talks about how you can see beings flowing into each other, both in the arts, the idea that karma, love, flows in to other beings and influences them from within. And actually Fred Smith uses my favorite example ever. He contrasts a Western horror film about possession and exorcism with a little Indian film called Paheli, in which a spirit possesses the husband. And I remember at the end of the spirit possesses the husband because he loves the husband's wife, and then says, you know, to the lady, it's great, we can be together now. I've just possessed your husband, so now I'm married to you, and we can be together forever, and everything's wonderful and happy. And then everyone dances, and that's the end of the film. And when my sister first saw this, she said, you know, but he just possessed that guy. That's really bad. And I had to explain, well, it's not like that. It's actually much more complicated, and their identities have merged, and it's okay, and possession's not always bad. You know, of course, if it was a Western movie, everyone would have to come out and get crosses and chop off heads, and they'd be screaming and shouting and sometimes vomiting. Anyway, so it turns out to be a negative thing in the West because they have a different concept of possession. And that comes up very strongly in texts like Fred Smith's text, and uses that contrast to show that. So I think in all kinds of ways, both in the Upanishadic definitions of the self, in the way that the deities themselves are seen as being able to take on different identities, in philosophical material, and I've put here a quote from the story of Sulabha in the Mahabharata, when she explains the nature of the self, the constituent elements of the body, she says, undergo a transformation from moment to moment in all creatures that is not apparent due to its subtlety, very Buddhist thing to say. The birth and death of particles in each successive condition cannot be marked, O king, even as one cannot mark the changes in the flame of a burning lamp. When such is the state of the bodies of all creatures, that is, when that which is called the body is changing incessantly like the fast movement of a fine horse, then who has come whence or not, is of whom or not, or arises from somewhere? So what is identity? And at the end of that, she says, the last sentence, as you see the essential self, the Atman, in the self, why then not recognize the essential self in another person, if you recognize the same self in all? Right? And that kind of statement, I think, is really important, again, for understanding the way that identity is seen in Hinduism. And it stands in a strong, marked contrast with the kind of what's called monadic selfhood that you get that's well documented in the Western tradition. The self is a little ball and it sits inside the head and it watches the Cartesian theatre, or for Leibniz it's literally involved in kind of monads of thought that are almost like little atoms and can't mix, can't merge. They can only displace each other or fight, but there's no kind of more fluid ontology behind them. So I think that's kind of helpful for a range of ways of understanding the self. In a way that also parallels a fluidity in the way of seeing the body. So I don't have the paragraph here that lists them all, but Dominic Wojcicki has a wonderful article on different conceptions in India of the body, going from the kind of whatever we mean by the physical body to the Ayurvedic body with its different systems, to the body of gunas made of different kinds of elements, the element body that you see in Samkhya made of an aggregate of different elements, the yogic body with its different channels and openings and flow going on within it. He talks about the wrestler's body with the different marman energy points. He talks about the alchemical body, which can be changed and transformed, the divinizable body in Tantra, in which you can install mantras or even deities to change its very nature as a physical object. And on through a range of different kinds of body. And that's reflected, I think, in the notion that the divine body, too, has different states, it has different modes that it can exist in. And I maybe would add to Dominic's model that sometimes the mind is the body of the self as well. So one doesn't assume that thoughts are in fact the self. One can talk about a body made of the imagination with which you engage in quote-unquote imaginal realities, realities that are existent in the imagination if not with your physical body. And a lot of bhakti involves that. One can talk about the body of samskaras, of memories, that accumulates your identity, or the body of emotions, or the body of karma that you carry with you, or the body of purity and impurity. So the wonderful Jain images are related to this, of a kind of an invisible body because it's had all its impurity removed. We had the emotion body or the thought body. So there are, and indeed the word body, kaya or deha or sometimes sharira, doesn't always mean a physical body. It often means a vehicle, almost the tool with which you act. So that to see even what a body is as the bounding of a self, as the object that a self is much more complicated and involves transformation and many states and many levels. So I think there are these different theorizations. We have a kind of the oceanic self. We have the many-leveled body. We have the indexical self, which is related to those things. And at some point I thought, okay, that's a lot of nice theory, but how do real people actually deal with this? Is there something that's not just philosophically grounded or whatever? And I think it's also true that there is maybe, before you get to all that, a questioning subject. So often you say the subject if you're not referring to the self as a this is me, but just the way that you exist in the world. And it seems to me from the very earliest periods, Hinduism isn't just telling you what's out there and reifying everything. It's often addressing you. It's often incorporating the reader as the questioner or as a thinker or as someone somehow involved in the very text and the discourse. And I just put a quote from the Nasadiya Sukta where I think you see this already. It's supposed to be telling you about the nature of the universe or cosmogony, the beginning of the universe. And actually what it does is already it asks questions and brings you in. Then even nothingness was not, nor existence. There was no air then, nor the heavens beyond it. And it starts asking, what covered it? Where was it? In whose keeping was there cosmic water in depths unfathomed? And at the end it returns, but after all, who knows and who can say whence it all came and how creation happened? The gods themselves are later than creation, so who knows truly whence it has arisen? And that questioning, that letting you in to the question is there, I think, also in the Upanishads, where so many of the discourses take the form of a questioning subject who you're supposed to relate to as the one being taught, and the continuing presence of the pupil questioning as the one who receives knowledge in Puranas. In epic literature, Arjuna the questioner, the various kings who go to deities to get questions answered, or even in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, is it Indra who goes to find out how many gods there are, the nature of the self? Even the gods go to each other as questioners, and you are put into the position of the one who's going, I'm involved in this, I want to know. So you get, it may be a kind of an implicit, untheorized presence of the self that you yourself are involved in all of these discourses. Okay, I think that's all I want to say. So I'm just kind of test driving these different categories to see if they're useful for explaining some of the differences and kind of bringing out the hidden implications of these different questions and themes and concepts in Hinduism. gone 5 minutes over. Any questions or comments or suggestions?
No, it was very... Before I came to the talk, I had a very clear conception of the divine. I thought it could be either somewhere there, Satyam Gyanam Anantam Brahma. Well, he's there. He's infinite knowledge. He's the truth. And he can be inside me. Akasha Shariram Brahma, Satyatma, Manananam, Prema, something. He's heart's delight and soul's comfort.
That's right.
So there are two kinds of divine.
But
now I'm very confused.
But that's helpful, actually, in some ways, because some of this, in some ways I'm talking about the broader scholarship and the wide range of Hindu literatures, but how does it actually work in people's understanding? And in some ways that also helps. It's there is this grand, large, cosmic conception, and there's a very personal... side as well, that with who it's not just in you, but there's a relationship within you. It brings bliss, it brings comfort, etc. And somehow mediating, explaining those two elements, it seems to me important.
Sorry, go on. Am I interrupting?
No.
Another thing. Again, it's my not infinite knowledge, very small knowledge, that the concept of the divine, it's evolutionary. It evolved from period to period. I mean...
That's interesting, yeah.
From it's a very simplistic way of categorizing it. Say, in the Upanishadic state, he's a Brahman. He's impersonal, he's featureless, he's unaccessible, etc., etc. Then came the conception of various deities, and in my mind I have this notion that there's a historical reason behind it, because I don't want to get into anyhow, there's a power vacuum in northern India after the first century, and first into BC, and by that time the Chinese emperor built this great wall of China, which prevented the Mongols from invading China and plundering them. So Mongols started to pressurize their neighbors, the Scythians, and Scythians started to pressurize the Greeks, who were there since Alexander the Great, and Greeks found a vacuum in India. They came there. They became Indianized, but they had very difficulty in accepting this impersonal God, this featureless.
So you're saying it's the Hellenic influence on Hindu?
Slightly before that, there was an etymologist in about 400 BC. He said that, impersonal God can have a personal significance. He can have his features and so on. And from stage on, all the various elements, all the various gods and goddesses evolved. I mean, God the cow's tail to God everything. So this is very evolutionary. Yeah. And at some stage, they had to, the Aryans, so the... if you believe in alien invasion, aliens had to accept the local deities. And that is exemplified in Bengali Mongol Kabbus, the Manusha Mongol Hana, this, that, and the other. They are not originally in the Hindi pantheon. They had to be admitted.
On this point, I was wondering, I mean, there seems to be a sort of deliberate ahistoricality to what you're...
Yeah, I was just thinking that I need to incorporate actually that historical developmental element.
There seems to be a point to you know, because you said that the majority of the way, you know, people have been studying this has been that historical method, and you're trying to do something different to it.
But it's an interesting... I mean, it's right that in some ways I'm trying to look for the rather than telling a story of the change of the concepts, because what happens then is you end up seeing, I think what's happening in scholarship right now is people are starting with one idea and realizing that idea has been there for a long time and affects a wide range of things. So David, so Fred Smith says, when I started to see that possession in one text, I started to see it in all kinds of forms, in a whole range of texts, and from a very early period on to a very late period. And I think there's something to be said for looking for those concepts and seeing how they work in that respect, although I certainly agree that in some ways I want to say that, let's say, embodiment or present and intimacy come to their fore later, once you've had Pancharatra and once you've had certain movements within Hinduism. So they're not all there all the way through. I think that's right. But also, but what you say in some ways makes me think that I need, at the end of each section, I think I want to have a bit where I, or at the beginning, where I say, here's a broad historical perspective on how these things are developing and changing.
That would be very helpful.
And also maybe, because I don't want to tell a historical story of Hinduism. No, there are a million books like that. But I think one of the things it helps to do is when people then come to Hinduism to study it again, they say, which one is it? And you have to be able to say, it's not one. It's many elements of all of these mixed together, right? And that sometimes history can serve to say which period is it and separate out material, but actually sometimes history can unite it back together and say, this is an accretion, it's an accumulation, it's, as you said, an evolution, so that what we're getting is really complex concepts at the end. And again, people haven't always looked to Hinduism for complex concepts. That's one of the negative impacts of the Orientalist kind of approach that was taken to it.